This is a download from the BBC. For more information and our terms of use, go to www.bbc.co.uk/radio3.
As a child growing up in the Jewish community, there were some people you'd hear about all the time. Moses Maimonides was one of them, although he was known more affectionately as the Rambam, which stands for Rabbi Moses ben Maimon. There was a kind of familiarity in the way people used that name. It was as if he were a living teacher or a colleague you could talk to about how to behave in a given situation. In fact, Moses Maimonides lived in the 12th century in Egypt, a celebrated theologian and judge whose many volumes on Jewish law are still in use today. He also wrote a major philosophical treatise and yet still found time to practice as a physician, treating everything from asthma to hemorrhoids. So you can imagine my surprise when I came across a page written in his very own hand. I had just joined the Geniza Research Unit to study the thousands of documents recovered from an ancient synagogue in Old Cairo, a vast hoard of manuscripts covering a millennium of community history, including almost everything put down on paper. Shopping lists, religious texts, letters, children's exercise books, divorce proceedings, and a brownish page covered in rather messy, rounded handwriting. There are doodles where the author has tested his pen, and thicker strokes after it was dipped in the inkwell. In places, words are crossed out, and bits are added in the margins. It's a rough draft of Maimonides' main philosophical work, his Guide for the Perplexed. The guide is Maimonides' attempt to explain Jewish religious texts in the light of reason and the Arabic philosophy of his time. In it, he has some rather surprising things to say about humans' relationship with God and their place in creation. "So that people know their own worth," he wrote, "they ought to reflect on the enormity of the heavens and the stars and the size of the distances between us and them. Consider this great and terrifying distance, how vast the dimensions and how great the number. What is the relation of the human species to all these created things, and how can we imagine that they exist for our sake and that they are instruments for our benefit?" His view might seem rather radical for a deeply religious person. Indeed, Maimonides' constant questioning of received ideas caused some of his books to be banned in certain circles. And yet, he was a highly respected religious authority, hardly part of some heretical fringe. This apparent conflict has always fascinated me, and thanks to the Geniza, I've been able to get some insight into the man behind the public image. And, just maybe, learn of a traumatic event that shaped his ideas. Maimonides had a brother called David. David was a trader, and he kept the family afloat, allowing Maimonides to pursue a life of learning and scholarship. The two were very close. In a letter found in the Geniza, David calls himself, "Your brother who longs for you, may God unite me with you under the most happy circumstances." David wrote this while he was travelling on business, after a grueling trek through the desert. He was on his way to the port of Aydab, where Egypt meets Sudan, but he was beset by problems along the way. He had intended to travel with a caravan belonging to a man called Ibn al-Rashidi, but he missed it and ended up with only a single companion. Crossing the desert, loaded with cash, they managed to avoid bandits and other hazards and made it to the port. But when they arrived, David heard that the caravan had been attacked and robbed, and some of the party had died of thirst. In the letter, David confirms his safe arrival. "All day long I imagine how you must feel when you hear about how Ibn al-Rashidi was robbed, and you believe that I was in his company." Then he announces that since he hasn't found the goods he wants, he'll take a ship to India, reassuring his brother, "Don't worry, the Almighty who saved me from the desert will save me at sea." But the ship sank, and David was lost along with the family fortune. So this letter was the last Maimonides ever heard from his beloved brother. It's a smallish page, but David has used every part of it, cramming extra notes into the margins. It's heavily wrinkled, and there are blotches. We know that for a whole year Maimonides was confined to his bed, the grief almost too much to bear. So I can imagine that some of the stains are his tears, some of the creases made as he clutched the letter to his chest. 8 years later, Maimonides was still in mourning. Now all joy has gone. He has passed away and left me disturbed in my mind. Whenever I see his handwriting or one of his letters, my heart turns upside down and my grief awakens again. These experiences must have informed Maimonides' views of humanity's insignificance. But, tragic though the loss of David was, death at sea was common in the Geniza community. Many 12th century Jews made their living as merchants, crossing the ocean in fragile ships. In previous generations, traders had based themselves in North Africa, sailing the length and breadth of the Mediterranean. But by David's time, they were more intrepid, shuttling between Egypt, Yemen, and India's Malabar coast, bringing back rare and exotic goods. Some, like David, lost their lives. Others lost entire fortunes. One letter commiserates, "Do not ask me, my master, how much I was distressed by the loss of the cargo belonging to you." The unlucky master it refers to was a man named Abraham ben Perahia, known to his friends as Ben Yizhu. From about 70 documents Ben Yizhu left in the Geniza, we know he was an ambitious merchant, a respected scholar, and an amateur poet. Arriving in India as a young man, he fell in love with the landscape. He decided to settle down. But marriageable Jewish girls in India were difficult to come by. So, Ben Yizhu came up with a very practical solution. He bought a beautiful Indian slave girl, named Ashu, which means nimble in Sanskrit. He then freed her. I know this because I've seen the deed of manumission that he himself wrote on the 17th of October 1132 in the city of Mangalore. It's the earliest recorded act of his long career. But why buy a slave only to free her? According to Jewish law, a freed slave is Jewish, so Ben Yizhu had created for himself a beautiful Jewish bride, and he promptly married her. Triumphing in a profession that had claimed the life of Maimonides' brother, Ben Yizhu went on to a successful business career in India, where he ran a bronze factory and traded widely. But as old age approached, he decided to return to the West and moved to Yemen and the port city of Aden, close to his brothers. He already had good business connections there and had been donating money for some years to the yeshiva, the local Jewish seat of religious government. But some of Aden's community leaders publicly questioned his marriage, suggesting it didn't conform to Jewish law, and raising the prospect that Ben Yizhu's children might miss out on their inheritance. The ever-practical Ben Yizhu petitioned the yeshiva for a ruling to end the speculation. This was a risky move, given that he'd eased over some legal details in purchasing his own wife. Yet it was the same yeshiva Ben Yizhu had been donating to, so it's no surprise to find his distinctive writing on another document, a legal ruling declaring his marriage lawful and valid. To lend further weight, he added a quotation from the Mishnah, the central book of Jewish law. If one says to a woman, "You are betrothed to me," after she is freed, she is betrothed. The problem is that the Mishnah says the exact opposite. She is not betrothed. Ben Yizhu has blatantly changed the text to suit his purposes. There are many accounts of such political wranglings, and none are more vividly described than the struggles of the 11th century Solomon ben Judah. He would hardly have approved of the way Ben Yizhu made free with the law, but, like Ben Yizhu, Solomon is only known through documents preserved in the Cairo Geniza. One eye-catching fragment bears his large and elaborate signature. His robust square script contrasts with the more cursive hands of the day. But there's elegance in its austerity. Solomon Hatzair, Solomon the Junior, an affectation of modesty. Because there's really only one Solomon of note, the temple builder, King Solomon of the Bible. To this, he adds his title, Rosh Yeshivat Geon Yaakov, head of the yeshiva of the Pride of Jacob, making him the highest Jewish authority in the Holy Land. This was a position Solomon viewed with some cynicism. All around the signature are a cluster of tiny letters. Combined, they spell out a quotation from the Book of Psalms. I am a worm and not a man. Elsewhere, he suggests that his title of Gaon is just that, a title, accompanied by neither power nor reward. And he even wishes he'd never been appointed to such a high office in the first place, so that there wouldn't have been those who curse me in my lifetime, as well as after my death. Solomon was one of the Geniza's most prolific writers, so we have an unusually clear image of his personality. It seems he had a crotchety bent. Even in official letters to his allies in Egypt, he highlights the poverty of his position, his frail health, and his lack of power. In another letter, he groans that his eyes have dimmed and that he writes like a young child, and wonders whether he'll live long enough to see his son return from a short business trip. Elsewhere, he complains, 5 women sit around me without a man, referring to his daughter's delinquent husband, who has left him to support her and her girls. These financial pressures must have pushed Solomon hard. Previously an upright man, who refused to take payment for dispensing legal judgments, he was caught out borrowing a large sum of money from the Jerusalem Poor Fund. At least, he claimed only to have borrowed it. He had to sell some clothes to settle the debt. Solomon's most serious trial came when a brash young man arrived, a scholar from the East with political connections. This man, Nathan ben Abraham, gathered allies and local troublemakers and declared himself Gaon, claiming the ancient title as his own. There was a major schism, and both Solomon and Nathan set up camps in rival synagogues from where they publicly excommunicated each other. For several years, Nathan had the upper hand as one by one, Solomon's former friends and allies turned against him. But then, in a document dated 8th of October 1042, the two rivals reached agreement. Nathan was stripped of his self-declared titles. It seems the wily Solomon, who called himself the humblest man in Jerusalem, had outfoxed his opponent by requesting intervention from the Muslim government, who stated their support for his position. Nathan had no choice but to back down. It's a compromise of sorts, because the agreement notes that Nathan should be next in line to assume the title after Solomon's death. But Nathan's clause was in vain. He died just a few years later, while the older, grumpier, and apparently weaker Solomon continued as Gaon for another decade. Solomon's struggles are not particularly heroic. They're the stuff of everyday life. But that's exactly what makes them so interesting. History is often composed of the lives of legends like Maimonides, known to us through their public writings. But the Geniza reveals their private lives too, and it allows us to see the other, more ordinary people standing behind them, like Maimonides' brother David, and David's fellow trader, Benijou. Now, almost 1,000 years later, hearing about their personal adversities, whether drowning at sea or simply getting into hot water with the local authorities, makes these medieval characters all the more relevant and present.